honor an outdated concept? This is the question that the gang, that is to say Harrison and myself, Donovan, are attempting to answer on this episode of Questions We Have No Answers. It's an intriguing one. One that I think would predictably branch into several different topics, circling around the unanswered question, as your average episode does. My name is Donovan, as previously stated. His name is Harrison, who's not spoken yet, so I'll give him the floor.
Yo!
And
that's all.
Yeah, and it's for an outdated concept. This was one of yours. And it's, to my mind, it sounds immediately more optimistic and emancipated than I think our current times in America have led reality to believe. So I'm interested in kind of seeing where this would go. We'll probably bring up, even though we are not constitutional scholars or immigration scholars, the DACA bill that's going on right now. As of today, on the night that we record this, there's a major budget bill that essentially is being shunned by Democrats because it's addressing all of their concerns except specifically the DACA immigration topic. And so the government's going to shut down again. And it's something that's on everyone's minds. And I think that the idea of the foreigner has definitely evolved over time. But how much space has that evolution actually – how much ground has that evolution actually gained? So what made you decide to word the topic of foreigners and introduce the idea of immigration or people that are different than us in this way, Harry? What the hell were you thinking?
I asked myself that. Well, I mean, in terms of questions, this one is definitely more leaning. It would be, in a courtroom drama, be thrown out immediately. And I think that's kind of why we assume a direct political branching path. I think when I was first thinking about it, it was just a matter of more theoretical, almost like for a longer term solution to the situation we're dealing with now and that we have always in this country and all around the world is, will this always be a thing? When the world kind of globalizes as it does, though we may resist it, will this idea of really foreign, I guess, and then kind of adding the foreigner makes it more political inherently. But will the idea of foreign always be something we have? Like, why is that? Not to just recycle Lindsay Ellis, but this isn't necessarily a bad term. It's a neutral term, although I'm not even sure that's true. But just in terms of my own perception, because there's kind of a give and take between globalization and heritage that, right, we don't want to erase our past as we move into the future. And I think that questioning the role of the idea, just the concept of foreign in that is kind of central. Or I mean, not so it's like, oh, I figured it out. Not quite that. But I think it's one dimension that again does have major political implications today. And it sounds even ridiculous to even talk about it now. Or does it, maybe? I don't know. So that's where we are now, I think.
What is relevant about this is that whereas 40 years ago when I was born, the question of having to deal with what is unspoken by the subjugated, what is never said to the master, of having to deal with this reality was a very remote possibility. It was in no one's mind. When I was growing up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history, and neither did I. That I was a savage, about whom the less said the better, who had been saved by Europe and brought to America. And of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. Those were the only books there were. Everyone else seemed to agree. If you walk out of Harlem, ride out of Harlem, downtown, the world agrees. What you see is much bigger, cleaner, whiter, richer, safer than where you are. They collect the garbage. People obviously can pay their life insurance. The children look happy, safe. You're not. and you go back home. And it would seem then, of course, that it's an act of God, that this is true, that you belong where white people had put you. It is only since the Second World War that there's been a counter image in the world. And that image not come about through any legislation on the part of any American government, but through the fact that Africa was suddenly on the stage of the world, and Africans had to be dealt with in a way they'd never been dealt with before. This gave an American Negro, for the first time, a sense of himself beyond a savage or a clown. It has created, and will create, a great many conundrums. One of the great things that the white world does not know, but I think I do know, is that black people are just like everybody else. One has used the myth of Negro and the myth of color to pretend and to assume that you are dealing essentially with something exotic, bizarre, and practically, according to human laws, unknown. Alas, that is not true. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. What is crucial here is that unless we can manage to establish some kind of dialogue between those people whom I pretend have paid for the American dream and those other people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble.
Well, it invites the idea that, like, if we consider the history of the human race and kind of think about the things that we do know about, you know, the American Revolution and different, you know, like the disillusion, that word.
No.
Or however it's spelled. You know, the separation between North Korea and South Korea, different borders, you know, Canada, Ireland and Scotland and those, you know, kind of like dicey comparisons. Things that really kind of divide different, you know, different sects of people, different countries, different borders. It's interesting to kind of theorize a reality where these don't upset us, I suppose. You know, there's the whole kind of like, I don't want to say necessarily separate equal thing, but the concept that we're appreciating everyone's culture and we enjoy everyone's culture and there's no sense of borders in the way. There's different sects, but there's not, you know, kind of like gates that we must, you know, that we must kind of break through or hop over. And if the idea of a foreigner is essentially somebody who is sort of like not intercepting, but, you know, kind of like penetrating the membrane of our collective society, and kind of like you're not supposed to be here initially, with the whole, you know, stereotypes of language and, you know, different traditions and all the kind of things that, like, we tend to take for granted. It's, oh yeah, we appreciate these things, but it does differentiate us. And so is that something that we cannot help but have exist just for recognition of individuality? Or is it something that is, if you're prompting it as an outdated term, something that's holding us back? And I'm trying to think about if there's any instance in American or history where such differences between people, you know, were since blurred and communities have kind of grown. And I guess, I mean, segregation is not, I don't know to what extent that would kind of like narrow down this topic, but it's definitely an example, especially if we're kind of speaking as Americans. I don't know if I feel as though that, like, the idea, the liberal idea, is definitely kind of make everyone equal in making differences of, you know, language and differences of culture not that big of a deal, but at the same time, the need to respect it and the need to acknowledge it kind of sets off different feelings about it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And I feel that, like, of course, education, communication, that's gotta, like, you know, if someone's coming at you differently. Well, you know, where I come from, we do this or this or this. That's not meant as a slight upon you. I think should be taught a lot more than it is. It's an interesting question because when we first talked about this question, what came to mind was like I think I mentioned this before, but like I like to watch different international dubs of Steven Universe, not the whole episodes, but like, you know, some songs or like the intro song or whatever. I've seen the intro theme song in like 30 different languages.
Nice.
And it's really cool that the Hindi one's version is awesome. But it's that kind of thing where it's like, that to me kind of feels like a type of utopia. Everyone's singing with the same cartoon characters in the same language, because it seems as though a sort of a celebration of an idea globally. I also think of, there was a video of Pharrell with Oprah, and she showed him that all across the world people were singing his happy song, one that Worldstar famously made fun of. But, you know, he was brought to tears, that kind of thing. That's sort of like global unity where we acknowledge that there are different people, but we also enjoy that we can all, we're all on the, you know, we're all wanting the same thing and we're all celebrating the same thing. And it kind of comes down to like, you know, we enjoy people who are different as long as they are rooting for the same things that we are rooting for. And ideally that would be the things that we find to be, you know, morally upright, like, you know, healthcare and raising our children and, you know, the pursuit of happiness. That kind of defines us as human beings, not just Americans, but, you know, just human beings. And the way in which we do that, or the way that we define those values through our laws, kind of defines our country. Even though a lot of countries are similar, and a number of them are actually better than Americans in some cases, like healthcare.
What? No.
Would you believe? But in that way, especially now with like technology like Skype, not that you and I are in different countries or whatever, but like email or even, I mean, I've seen people going, you know, there are foreign language apps on the phone to help translate, you know, if you're in, like, let's say you're in Japan and you need to talk to somebody. It's hell, no, that, not even that. I've seen, my mom watches this show called 90 Days Fiancé, where these people meet on dating sites across the world and get together to marry each other in like 3 months. It's torrid. But, I've seen some. There was a guy who was in, I think, Barcelona, and he was communicating with his fiance through like, they were sitting on the same bed, and they were like kind of communicating through this sort of like translator phone, which is wild. But like, that's kind of like making the world much smaller, and it actually does kind of, you know, help to bridge. I mean, it obviously bridges gaps and, you know, brings forth communication. So because of that, is it because of the onset of technology and our willingness to kind of have, basically our willingness to kind of come together through the technology, did that kind of spark the idea of outdating the idea of a foreigner in your mind? Was it that, or was it just kind of like, was it just a gradual inevitability that you would imagine sooner or later would happen?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of that, you know, globalization and everything, and seeing for sure technology bring us together and all the amazing things that have happened there. But also I think there was an element of just conceptually how we get there. And so I think one of the questions that I kind of want to focus on, or at least just to start out with, is kind of measuring the idea measuring the measure of foreigner or foreign to say that, like, how would you, or like, when is somebody not a foreigner, basically, I think is kind of at the crux of this episode. Like, is it at citizenship? Is it generational? I mean, even like, even just for you, not even just for like Americans, when is somebody not a foreigner?
It's a very good question. I think of when I was in the fourth grade. I was in one of those. Sit down. I remember in the fourth grade there was a classmate of mine who was from Egypt. I still remember his name, Mina Eskandar. I wonder whatever happened to him. But you know, he was in our class. I don't remember him being kind of like bandied about as a foreign exchange student. It wasn't that sort of like, you know, cartoon scenario. But you know, he came from a different culture, and you know, he knew English, but it was through a heavy accent. But I think as a kid, there's like stuff that you kind of see represented on, in the media, and then stuff you kind of like have to deal with on the day to day. So it wasn't anything I really considered until I went to his birthday party, and it was just a very, very different kind of thing. Like it was a very like it was a pretty big family. It wasn't too dissimilar from your average birthday party with cake and presents and stuff. But I remember it feeling like I had never kind of been through. It wasn't there were any different traditions, but I think it was just kind of the atmosphere of a place that wasn't innately, I guess, American born. But in the classroom, it was like, you know, he was just one of our classmates. He was just a kid who that was no different than any of us. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it's like when we're kind of when the foreigner is basically doing the same things that we are doing, and there's nothing about them brings about the idea that they're foreign, unless they're like a Sikh or something, and they're wearing like kind of like head coverings, or they're Muslim and they're wearing like any sort of like a religious clothing. But even then, I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I've worked with Muslims, and like, oftentimes, it's just that's just part of who they are. I don't know if I really consider people who are not from America foreigners, because I mean, technically, I do, but I don't really.
Doesn't mean anything to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily. It's not a big highlighted sign in my mind's eye in terms of when I think about them. I feel like a foreigner feels like no matter what, you can never get past the fact that this person is not from where you are in a permanent way. Like they can't assimilate. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've ever really felt that way. All throughout school, I remember, you know, kids being from different places. There was a guy from Japan that I met in college. And it was just, you know, okay, well, we have differences of backgrounds, but it's just, you know, we're here now. You know, we both exist on the same planet, and by evidence, by being in the same building, sitting in the same seat. So, yeah, being a foreigner to me is just, foreigner feels more like, not necessarily a slur, but just sort of, an invective kind of statement. It's like, oh, you're a foreigner, you know. Not that, and it's initially neutral, right? Like you said before, but like it feels more like a separative kind of term rather than a statement of fact, a statement of somebody. Like I don't know how I would like differentiate a foreigner and an immigrant in essence. I suppose an immigrant, somebody who actually comes to stay here, whereas a foreigner is somebody who just happens to be here, whether on accident or otherwise. But I feel as though that, like, it was never really made real for me enough that, like, it ever became, like, a big deal for me in terms of, like, politics or anything like that. What about you?
Well, that's why you're a good person, so we say, and so we believe.
Until the season finale.
Yeah, all is revealed. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, I would agree with you. It's about borders, you know, not even the borders that – quote unquote physically exist, like that line between Texas and Mexico that goes through all the golf courses or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But the ones that are in our minds too. And when we go to a different country, what kind of preconceptions do we have? Do we think that there are just going to be impassable gulfs? And obviously there are things that reinforce those borders, like language barriers and cultural norms and not wanting to be or maybe trying to mitigate your ethnocentric instincts or whatever, you know, not judging those savage Koreans for eating dogs, which people, I mean, that's a problem for me politically, but I'm not going to, you know, talk about it. It's funny, and probably the idea was kind of spurred also by watching, you know, things like the Steven Universe with different countries doing the theme song. But for me, it was like watching a lot of videos starring Hideo Kojima and seeing how different interviewers would kind of approach the English Japanese translation, whether they'd have a guy there or whether they'd dub it over afterwards. And then, I mean, it's so hard to watch interviews with like any kind of Asian movie director like Chan-wook Park, because they'll, you know, the British guy will ask him a question, and then he'll, like, you know, he's nodding, the translator's talking in his ear, and then he'll speak, and he'll be like, okay, stop. And then you'll just wait there for, like, 20 minutes, and then the translator will say something that was, like, half as long, and then it just goes, and it's kind of hard to deal with that. But, I mean, with Hideo Kojima specifically, you also have situations where he's on stage with somebody like Guillermo del Toro, or, you know, Norman Reedus or Mads Mikkelsen. These, a lot of
his best friends.
His best buddies. And Guillermo del Toro is bilingual, but he doesn't speak Japanese. And Hideo Kojima doesn't speak Spanish or English. He knows, like, some English because he has to say, welcome, or whatever, when he's on E3 or something. But, you know, Guillermo del Toro will talk about how they go to karaoke together and they'll sing, like, Giant Robot songs. And they don't either of them can really communicate with each other in a traditional way. But that's how they communicate, essentially. And also Junji Ito gets in on that, which is I don't even want to imagine. Because I've read some of his comics, and those are the freakiest shit. But anyway, mm-hmm. So I think he used the word membrane earlier, like all that kind of like, you know, piercing you through, but obviously not so violently as that imagery might suggest. But, you know, the diffusion of peoples and how culture evolves by different kinds of people interacting. I think my family is actually going to go to Korea next year. And so I've been spending a little bit of time trying to learn Hangul and stuff like that. I've got like a few vowels down, but I'm probably going to go off the rails soon and just say forget it. But you know, I've watched some videos of people like in their life in Korea, and there was one where this lady went to the mall with her husband, and it was just like the mall that I go to that's across the street from me in Burbank, across from my work, I should say. You wouldn't know the difference. I mean, there's so much English everywhere, first of all. I mean, Korea is like super huge on English. Like that's their secondary language that they learn, as we would learn Spanish or French if right. you're an idiot. I'm just kidding. But Spanish is obviously, you know, that's like has specific utility. Yep. And I guess English would for them too. So yeah, that kind of stuff. And like, I think the more, I don't know, I don't want to say like explore or whatever, or even travel, but I think there are certain hurdles that you have to overcome, in terms of thinking about the world. But once you do, you see that that people are, you know, just like us at a certain foundation. And we can talk later about preconceptions and why those exist and why even they have to exist sometimes because of heritage, which is kind mm-hmm. of the monkey wrench as far as I'm concerned in this whole thing.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about that. And I was actually thinking of like when I was what I just previously said, I was being honest, right? And yeah, I was. I do when you brought up Hideo Kojima and his best friends, I thought about like Comic-Con and how Comic-Con. I mean, it's like the biggest comic convention in the world, and like it really just bring about. You know, 50% of it is are like Asians from California, but 50% are like people from everywhere else. And I remember seeing people at like Marvel Comics panels. Like people from like Italy and what you name it, like people who clearly traveled to America to come to those cons, talking about you know their favorite characters or what have you. I remember this girl at a Bruce Timm panel was giving this unfortunately way too long kind of like confession about how much those cartoons meant to her, which was just heartfelt and then a little embarrassing.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it's that kind of thing where like you know. Content and the things that we enjoy bring us together, like the Steven Universe theme song or the Steven Universe show. Taka Furuhori, I think it is. He's a key animator from Trigger. He did work on Kill la Kill, and he did key animation work for Mindful Education, that was Steven Universe. And he's a gigantic Steven Universe fan. I know he still works in Japan, but like just on his own blog or Tumblr, he just like animates the characters and like kind of on his free time. It's interesting seeing a Japanese guy from a different culture like illustrate in Japan his fandom for an American cartoon. I remember I mentioned that there was a guy from Japan in when I was in college, and he was I think he came there for baseball or something. I know that he went into like some sort of baseball, I'm not sure if it was coaching position, but something to do with baseball. But he was into sports, and like that was actually when I discovered something I'm really, really falling back into now, the Hajime no Ippo boxing manga. And we were talking about you know, enjoying that because it was a sports series. And he said that like his favorite fight was when one of the characters went up against like a real nasty piece of work. And then he worried that he was being offensive towards me because like the evil boxer was American. And I was like, no, I don't care. Which is interesting to me because like that would be kind of like the knee jerk liberal thing for me to do. Like, oh, you know, I should like it when, you know, Wonder Woman fought Dr. Egg Foo or whatever.
Asumimase.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of bridged it even further or bridged it even closer. Kind of the whole shared media thing. And I guess geeks initially, I'm trying to think of like, you know, but besides the whole, like, you know, like making characters black thing or making any character not white thing. But before that is introduced, like in terms of like, I was really under the impression like 10 years ago that like geeks were a lot more inclusive in terms of racial dynamics.
So you'd think.
Yeah. It was a violent awakening, but, I mean, I still feel that like the good ones, the ones that we like to talk about and hang out with are incredibly inclusive. In terms of, and I don't want to step too quickly into it if you were kind of like going to leave into it, but like just very quickly, in terms of like perceptions, I would say that like recently, as in the last few years, especially with like how kind of politics are, if I notice somebody who has a heavy accent, who's visibly not from America, in whatever way. Like if I notice that like an Asian couple speaking in Korean or Japanese or Chinese or whichever language it's going to be at work or whatever, I feel that like I go out. I don't want to say I go out of my way, but like I feel like I give an extra concerted effort to kind of like make things easy for them because I'm just imagining that like they're going to get a lot of shit from anybody else, especially in the South. Not that Nashville, Tennessee is a harsh place to kind of live, but like, you know, kind of going to schools and hearing how people say about people who are foreigners and people who are not white. I'm just anticipating that like they had to kind of go into certain shops or whatever and kind of deal with that sort of language barrier. Like there's this couple with their baby at Barnes & Noble, and like they were up for like a membership, and I went extra slow just to make sure that I wasn't trying to come off across as some sort of huckster taking advantage of their, you know, foreignness, for lack of a better word. Because I don't know, because I feel that like that's as common as not. So I feel that like my perception is always, you know, they're probably having to deal with a lot of shit from guys like me. So I'm going to not be that guy and kind of go the other way around. And I don't mean to be condescending or patronizing, but that is kind of like my knee-jerk reaction. Something that's been sort of that's been a more active part of my interaction rather than when I was much younger.
Right, and that's why we say that, you know, nobody's colorblind or whatever. You notice and respond to your interactions change based on this person's appearance and the way they speak and just the way they are. And it's such an important thing to note because when we say things that like it's. I guess when we react to people who say, oh, I'm not racist, or perhaps I'm the least racist person you've ever interviewed, which is that's probably the best thing he's ever said. it's, you know, that it's at its core, racism stems from a kind of neutral place, which is just psychological biases. But once we kind of enter into this world with those biases and they interact with our in-group and looking outward, then that's when things get problematic, and even those biases can be eliminated or reduced, I believe. And I guess part of that work is, you know, checking yourself, I guess, when you are in situations where there are other kinds of people. But yeah, so I mean, that's a good example of like when perceptions and preconceptions are kind of good or neutral. Like you are not trying to be malicious; you're actually trying to accommodate for a certain experience, which is great, I think. But then those situations are going to be around for a while, that we are going to have instances of cultures connecting being a kind of clash of cultures. And so why is that? And it might
Also we're in an imperfect culture where interaction with different cultures is still like kind of a car crash in a way.
Yeah,
it's not regulated. Like I don't know, unless you live in New York, I guess, how often, you know, interacting with different cultures would be, considering, you know how separated the whole world is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just like Yeah, I mean, in a situation like that, or more conceptually, this situation, like, it seems like the problem that we have to kind of overcome to reach a better tomorrow. But I think that's going to be hard, as we've alluded to, because people are attached to the culture that creates those clashes, and it has to be that way. Like, for me, like, thinking about this kind of offhand all the time, like, I'm somebody who is essentially a foreigner because I was not born here. But I don't, I mean, I guess I do think of myself that way, obviously, or a lot of the times unstuck from my surroundings, which is just a weird way to be and not always constructive. But like, I put no stock in heritage because I don't have it. And maybe that's just a bias, but I also, like, whenever I even conceptualize about the future and a more globalized, like, Star Trek style world, like, those people don't have a certain level of histories. I mean, Star Trek is kind of a bad example because that's one of those, like, Mass Effect or anything where instead of having nations, they just have races. So they're like, oh, the Klingons or, oh, the Romulans. But it's like, that's a little racist.
It's also inconsistent if you consider, like, you know, like, I don't know, like the background of Sulu exactly, but you know, that was a very kind of certain effort to put a Japanese guy in the main cast. But you have like Chekhov and Scotty, who have these very thick accents, which would imply that they come from another country that's not America, yeah. And yet like, they're all kind of together. It's not well explained.
And I mean, Star Trek, and there was something else too that I was thinking of there. That had it was actually the Cloverfield Paradox, where they had another kind of crew on a spaceship, but I don't think any of them were American. Like, they all spoke English. You also had Zhang Ziyi in that movie, which was pretty amazing because I thought she threw a smoke bomb and disappeared like 10 years ago. I mean, she was in The Grandmaster, but nobody saw that.
Right.
I mean, I think there were Americans, but it was like just because like this guy's white, like he's actually Daniel Brühl, who's like, you know, the most ethnic white guy you're ever going to see because he's like German or something. Mm-hmm. And he's got a heavy accent. And so it's just kind of weird to think about that. But also, I mean, I think there's also the Generation Starship kind of exercise where, you know, we say that like, oh, in the future, everybody's just going to be gray or beige because there's just going to be so much like cross-pollination between ethnicities that they're going to change. And then when you kind of take that outside the context of nations on Earth, like we're not going to have a space Korea. I mean, probably we're going to have a new America. And a new America because we're just so fucking obsessed with ourselves. But let's say America gets nuked and then just everybody else goes into space like Gundam Z or something.
I was literally thinking
was
Gundam.
That was that the one?
Every Gundam series, even if it's like not in continuity with the main one, it has the same kind of like a background plot where like war sent people into space essentially.
Yeah, and I think there's one anime, I think it might be that one, where they actually lift off the actual, like, countries, like the physical parts of Europe.
Oh, yeah, it might be one of them.
That's pretty good.
It's everyone except for, like, G Gundam, which is this silly fighter show.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's say that there are representatives from multiple Earth nations on a Generation Starship. You know, you go, like, 20 generations later, and what are those kinds of people then? And you would still have races if the ship was, like, big enough and diverse enough correlative to Earth, because the only reason why we have races is because environments are different and they impact skin color, eye shape, facial features, that kind of thing. And so race would never go away. It would just be a matter, unless you just had a completely uniform environment for the entire species, and then race would go away. But even then you would still have differences because, you know, I don't look like my mom, I assume. Ha! That's too sad to be said on this podcast right now. but my sister Gracie doesn't look like my mom, even though they are blood related, and even though they do, but they don't look exactly the same. And so you're always going to have differences genetically, and that comes out into physical features, and that turns out into races and things like that. So then it's a matter of understanding that things are arbitrary. And having a strong enough sense of history that you want to not care when people are different. And so that's kind of the conflict, the paradox even, which is how do you remember the sins of the past so you don't repeat them, but also kind of excise yourself from the past? And frankly, I need to get your perspective in this if you are more less, or I should say less anti-heritage than I am.
Well, yeah, no, that's, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, because obviously Black American is a very specific type of ethnic identity, and we're recording this, and this is the episode before Black Panther comes out.
Really?
It's this day next week it comes out.
Oh, okay.
So there's just been like a lot of discussion. There's just been a lot of like excitement over, you know, a powerfully displayed all black cast, and even if it is African specifically, it's not American at all. Right. Although the villain Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan, was born in Africa, was born in Wakanda, but was raised in New York, so he sounds like Michael B. Jordan, which I'd forgotten about. So that's the worst African accent I've ever heard. Oh, wait, it's not.
Well, it's better than Leo's in Blood Diamond. Except that was South African.
I've heard about. Oh, very quick tangent, but like the Black Panther toy that we sell in Barnes & Noble for some reason has like a Jamaican accent.
No,
how could you? It's like, oh, I'll get you, Killmonger.
I. Oh man,
it's like West Indian. No, it's like, who's responsible for this?
Who's responsible?
Anyways, I remember when I was in 11th grade. I think my parents went to Tunisia, and I don't know why we didn't go with them, but the idea of like actually traveling to Africa was never in my head. It wasn't something I kind of shut out. It was just never a concept because I grew up very, very unaware of everything. But now as I think about it, I hear about the whole, we got to go back, man, back in the 80s kind of thread. And as I get older, and you know, Stella, my friend who I always mention all the time, she's actually going to Kenya for a couple of months on some sort of like missionary trip. So I'm thinking, like, you know, would this mean anything to me if I actually went back to Africa? And in hell, I mean, even I mentioned Black Panther. Ryan Coogler said that he didn't sign on to take the job to direct the film until he himself visited Africa.
Oh, wow!
He kind of had that kind of sense, and he said that, like, you know, he can't imagine any black person who would go to Africa and not feel anything. Mm. And it's kind of made me kind of a lot more, like, it kind of stops me in my tracks whenever I think about it now. It's like, you know, I'm not. Like James Baldwin says, I'm not a ward of the state. You know, I'm American. I'm part of this country. But at the same time, there is sort of like this, you know, there are galaxies within myself and, you know, my very first ancestor in terms of, like, you know, kidnapping and bondage and all that kind of stuff, where I would have to kind of reconcile with. And it's very mixed of emotions. I don't feel necessarily sad or anything, but it's sort of like, I don't know how I should respond to this, but it definitely does have me thinking. And in that way, it's like, because Africans would see me as a total foreigner, like they would not see me as one of their own, and as well they shouldn't, because I wouldn't necessarily see them as somebody I could relate to. I remember I took an African literature class in college. I took a lot of literature classes in college, and my professor, Ms. Kizza, was from Africa. She was from Nigeria. And the very first day, the first day of class, she sort of showed us this sort of like travel video, like visit this part of Africa or whatever. And she said she specifically did that to kind of show off all the really nice parts about Africa, because she didn't want us to kind of come in with preconceived notions of it being sort of a third world continent where everything is awful forever. And then we read Things Fall Apart. But
cool.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where it's like, the idea of who created the idea of the foreigner, essentially, you know, like it wasn't. You know, this is something that where we can't specifically just lay at the feet of like white European people. Although, you know, we can and we will, but not entirely, because it's like I feel like there's an invisible wall of bars between me and African people, unless I just start to live there forever, and I wouldn't necessarily want to do that, but I it's tough. I've never felt, you know, the heritage that I've had to kind of come up with is one that kind of see in other people, and kind of we as Black Americans, we kind of make for ourselves in America. Can I come up with it? Can we come up with our own perceptions and our own musings and ponderings upon our situation that we've kind of, you know, had to been forced to deal with, and kind of recognize the sort of will of ignorance that the rest of the country that's not black kind of carries around in terms of currency. And then once we see that, or at least once I see that, I kind of see how that would be for other different types of people, like, you know, like feminists say, oh, I'm not that kind of feminist, or, you know, other foreigners trying to distance themselves from different kinds of people and trying to kind of make their own identity real. I mean, Lord knows I do that. And so it feels like it reminds me of what my brother said, where it's like, you know, ultimately, is even the idea of race something that is anything but negative? And it's something where it's like, without actually investigating that, like, in terms of the foreigner, it's like, it feels like a chain, to put it quite literally. but I don't know. I mean, because have you ever encountered? You said you went to a Korean church and stuff, and, you know, you have a buddy or two. You were Asian American. I mean, have you ever? It doesn't sound like you were ever to talk about this with other folks. And I'm not saying that you would have, but have anybody ever talked to you about, you know, how they feel they should kind of come off, or has there ever been sort of like even a type of understanding between, you know, yourself and like other Asian Americans or other Asian adoptees or even people online in terms of how they talk about it? Is it always much like a case by case basis and sort of, or is there sort of this sort of nebulous understanding that a lot of black people claim to be a part of?
I don't know. My experiences with any kind of quote unquote Korean community has been so far in the past. I don't really remember anything. And so my kind of education about myself as an Asian American and what that even means has always been independently and way too late because of that. Like learning things, critical things in college, for example, discovering Bruce Lee around that time. Like Bruce Lee was not a part of my childhood or anything like that. And discovering kind of like the representational disproportion in media, which I watched as a kid and studied even as a kid, and I just never noticed that or thought about it.
Me too.
Yeah, so I don't know, like what's wrong with us? Like what happened? Parents drop us on our head?
No, I feel that like and this is kind of when I think about my parents. You know, my parents, if they're not listening to this right now, then they're knocked down. They both came up quite poor. My mom was born in Harlem, you know, came from the Bronx. My dad was in Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, they lost their fathers when they were kids, and they worked hard, as one might imagine they ought to do. Both went to college and became very educated. And by the time my brother and I came up and we were kind of growing up through the 90s, there wasn't really an education in terms of, you know, what we were, in terms of how America saw us. I don't know if they thought that we would kind of deal with it ourselves or whatever, but like there was very, very few conversations about how we would be kind of perceived. And of course, we're not foreign. We're in terms of like, you know, we were born in America, but they never really introduced to us ideas that we could not do anything because of our skin color. And maybe that was kind of seen as affirmational and positive in their perspectives, and maybe they're living proof of that. But it's one of those things now where, like, we're kind of dealing with that kind of reality bouncing back into the forefront now, and especially with people like I don't know how that would be for like DACA babies who would kind of come here at age 3, kind of grow up, and if their parents did well and kind of came up middle class, I'm not sure how they would be introduced to the idea that they would be kind of seen as not from here. But they would be. And it's that's kind of one of the things. It's like that's the point where American pride, or, you know, the idea of people who are different than you, is conjured up as something that's threatening. Like who created the foreigner? You know, to paraphrase James Baldwin again. like what purpose does that exactly serve? You know, we all kind of come up different. It's that kind of thing where, like, you know, when people, like, for instance, just hate on Hispanic people. You know, like, oh, why can't they speak English? They live here. It's like, well, they can't speak English as well as I can, which means they're dumb because I can speak English. They can't communicate with me, which means they're not smart to communicate with me. That's what's going on in their head, even though everyone has the exact same, you know, the exact same base level of intelligence. It's just in terms of communication. And believing that there's an intrinsic superiority and inferiority power dynamic makes people feel good about themselves. I was listening to something earlier tonight about a former skinhead and Klansman who kind of reformed and is, like, you know, talking to people about, you know, how to kind of stay away from that kind of thing. And said that, like, you know, the people who kind of recruit others for hate groups, it's all kind of preying upon vulnerability and sense of community rather than, hey, you hate POCs, come with us. It's not really, that's not really advertised in the beginning. It's a lot more like, you know, sort of you feel lonely and in your feelings and kind of, you know, picked on or whatever. And so they kind of brought into this sort of brotherhood. And then it's like, by the way, how do you feel about black people? yeah. So it's that kind of thing where I think a sense of community that you can kind of fall into with other people sort of dictates who those who don't fit into that. And erasing the concept of the foreigner would obviously kind of sort of enlarge in that community and make sure that everyone's – it's like what you're talking about with Craziest Girlfriend. Everyone is able to live and exist, all types of people in the Craziest Girlfriend universe. There's no real concept of a foreigner, even if it's scary at first. Like, you know, who's that new guy?
That's true. So what does that process of erasing the foreigner look like? Because it can't be cultural assimilation, because we've experimented with that. I mean, America is a colonial nation. We've had a dark history with genocide and cultural genocide and things like that. So that's not the way to go. And so when we have a specific case, like we're dealing with immigrant populations from brown skin countries, I mean, that's really the line, as even the president of the United States pointed out, between Norway, who we weren't even talking about, and Mexico and Africa and places like that. So it can't be cultural assimilation. But what is it, and what is it for those kinds of people? And I think, I mean, to go back to Guillermo del Toro again, like he's like in the big three of like Mexican American directors, or I don't even know if he's American, but Mexican directors who've had success in America.
Him, Rodriguez, and
who was that? I don't know if he works with Rodriguez, but it was him, Iñárritu, and Cuarón, because they've actually worked together. They might have made a company briefly. But also Robert Rodriguez, who I completely forgot about, director of such fine films as Alita: Battle Angel, coming soon.
And Spy Kids 4.
Oh my gosh, yes, all the money in the or all the time in the world. I think I don't know why I remember that.
All the money in the world.
Spy all the money.
Awesome.
Mark Wahlberg was there. But you know, guys like that, like, they're so important because, especially Guillermo del Toro, who gets in front of the camera a lot, and he's on Conan O'Brien showing off the Bleak House or whatever. And he's so important because we don't have a lot of people from, you know, Spanish-speaking countries south of the border to kind of interface with our preconceptions, which are often racist. You know, when Trump was talking about, you know, the very first or yeah, I guess the very second things about how Mexicans are rapists and stuff, like, that doesn't come from nowhere. That's not just him. And that's why he's been so successful, is because he just put into incredibly what's the opposite of eloquent words, like, a lot of people's anxieties about other countries.
Verbal vomit.
And so we need more Guillermo del Toro's. We need more. Oh, God, what's her name? Like Camila Cabello from I mean, she's not from Mexico, but people like that, you know, people who don't sound like us when they speak, they have an accent, they have a lot of history that they can talk about in their life stories. I think that's one of the things that will, you know, as a kind of like ultimate measure, but also way too long term to really talk about right now in terms of an answer to overturning DACA and sending, you know, deporting people you know, we have essentially the American Gestapo or SS right now, which is ICE. And it's kind of unbelievable, the stories that come up and recognizing that stories about deportations now are what's going to be remembered from our lifetimes and kind of like, and people are going to ask, like, why didn't anybody intervene? And obviously people are, ACLU and lawyers, lawyer people are overworking themselves to save people. And
I mean,
Nancy Pelosi, even like a guy like Seth Meyers, like he got on, I think, last night to talk about the term chain migration. And it was funny because the way he was talking about it was like, this just came to me. But chain migration is a bad term. But obviously that's groundswell that's been happening online, at least for a while now. But that's true. I mean, there's a lot of things that even our liberal minds have to kind of wrap around. But yes, I mean, there's also just a lot of preconceptions about illegal immigration, and we can kind of talk about that too. Because I mean, certainly back in the day when this would come up, like, people would say that, like, oh, illegal immigration impacts the economy, and I wouldn't be able to say anything because I don't know enough about the economy. But I think nowadays we can definitely recognize that it's about something else.
Yeah, that's bullshit. If you go to the I gotta make sure I know the exact term of the group, because this entire website what kind of spells it. If you go to the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and all those concerns about the economy, I mean, that's just a flat out lie. The DACA situation has people, you know, it's not a welfare thing. It boosts the economy, it boosts jobs, and not only would like kind of getting rid of it cost way too much money, you lose like $460 billion from the workforce. It costs like $60 billion to take out, and it would bring losses to Social Security, Medicare over the next decade of $39.3 billion. Everyone hears this, but like empirically, there is no swelling of criminal activity or criminality from immigrants. You know that we need to be concerned about, because there's a lot more pressing issues in terms of the economy and budget that's not coming from American illegal immigrants. That's not coming from any sort of voter fraud. This shit's been kind of bandied about since the Reagan administration, and it's an old favorite that's kind of just being bandied about because Ann Coulter told Donald Trump to say that in his first speech when he announced that he was going to run for president. Mm-hmm. That's literally what's going on. That's not an exaggeration due to anger. The links will be on the website. Because you see these things, this is all kind of like cyclical. This sort of like fear of the brown person, this sort of fear that like the country is being lost. And it's something we've talked about before in terms of our Nazi playlist in terms of this podcast. But it's just that's that kind of thing where like people see how certain terms are going away, like foreigner, or certain realities, like, you know, like how the country is changing, and they just decide they don't like it. That's how it was back in the, you know, back during the civil rights era, where, I mean, like, I was kind of, not really researching, but I fell into sort of, kind of like investigating, then looking up Angela Davis and that whole thing about the Soledad gang, the Soledad brothers and the traveling kind of stuff. And that's the kind of thing where a lot of it is for show and sort of like propaganda, using the law for propaganda almost. I mean, I remember Trump saying, like, you know, we got to build a wall to find out until we find out what the hell is going, or the Muslim ban until we find out what the hell is going on. It's like he's not referencing anything. This is not 2002, so it's one of those things where the idea. I mean, did we mention that thing with Jimmy Kimmel and like the DACA family talking to those people who wanted them out of the country? Did you see that?
I didn't see it, but we might have referenced it briefly last time.
Yeah, it was awful. You had a guy literally just scream at this like young couple with their baby, like, you got to get out of the country, when it's been explained to them that they were brought in, and this guy was in the military, and they've gone through all the channels and done everything legally, and it's rigged to work against them, and just like the utter like the soullessness of this person demonstrates that there's for some people there's just people. There's just a twisting of the mind, and they're living wrong, and I think like I was kind of saying before, you know, ultimately, if you have an opinion about your fellow man, then the idea of foreigner is sort of a porous term that doesn't really have a lot of scrutiny when you kind of really care about it, you know. Of course, there's going to be different distances of cultures and all that kind of stuff, but ultimately, you're not going to, like, really matter. Because you feel that people are intentionally good. It's like what you were saying several episodes ago. If you see everybody as a potential friend, you know, you're not going to see them as representing everything that's against what you stand for. Because they don't. We got enough of that here. so, yeah, there's no real argument in this scenario. It's just sort of a sort of an example of modern day, you know, kind of gatekeeping that this country has kind of always had to kind of contend itself with, kind of banning about this idea of progressive morality, progressive politics, and liberty and freedom, and you know, with the other hand, kind of trying to take it away from people that they'd rather not have it. It's pretty much America's. It's pretty much America's truly enduring tradition, and the more I learn about it, and the more hypocritical history reveals itself to be, and kind of the more blatant it appears to be in terms of modern politics, in terms of like what's going on right now in the White House, it kind of, you know, as we say before, it makes conversations like these more urgent, and our hopes of kind of, you know, distributing information about that, you know, kind of more life or death, in my mind.
Mm-hmm. It just so concerns me because I'm on the ACLU website right now looking at how in 1993 there was a poll in California that said 39% of respondents agreed that illegal immigrants are taking jobs away from Californians. And California and Massachusetts often seen as kind of the blueiest of the blue. But, you know, you have that thing in South Park that became kind of a meme that spoke, unfortunately, to a lot of truth. And I don't think we even realized because maybe that South Park thing accidentally took the fangs out of it.
Which one was it?
Turk or Gerb.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. the Turk or Gerbs.
I mean, that was pretty funny.
That was funny. Yeah, that made me laugh.
But kind of defeating that misconception isn't saying or isn't even proving scientifically that that's not true, because obviously, I mean, we know that that's not how you deal with people who are kind of entrenched in these kinds of beliefs that have no basis in reality. They are not working with a kind of rational mindset or whatever from the jump. So how do you kind of communicate to these people that, you know, the people who are here from Mexico or any country, nothing about, well, it's weird because you can't say, and this is kind of the complication, you can't say nothing about their Mexican heritage influences their character, but it doesn't matter. So how do you get them to say that that doesn't matter? And I think that it is kind of based on perceiving your fellow man as a potential friend, and how that happens definitely isn't from erasing heritage, but embracing it in a way. But When you have a situation like this that we're faced with now with quote-unquote illegal immigrants, it's kind of this unfortunate loop where the solution to that problem is better representation for those people, but you can't have better representation if they're all deported. So it's really frustrating. And so we have a kind of antagonistic mind that is unfortunately running the country right now. And we think, how do we properly educate that mind to a truth, or to humanism, whatever, to an end that is everybody's happy? Because what these people don't realize is that they can be happy coexisting with other kinds of people. But how do we prove that? And that's kind of the big question, I guess, that we'll all have to keep addressing. But I don't know. Do you have any?
honestly, in the way that like we kind of like kind of gone down this street, I don't think this is actually very difficult. In my view, some people are just too late to save, in terms of like, you know, like the white grandpa looking dude wearing the Make America Great Again hat. Yeah, we don't worry about them. We're worried about them.
You never know.
I mean, ideally you would, but they are so old and they are so buried in their myth of how reality works, even after, like, you know, decades and decades of you know, potential education, that I feel that, like, if we're going to kind of make any sort of sacrifice, we sacrifice them. Not to our God!
But to the sun god.
Yeah. Oh. I think my grandfather in this says, let's sacrifice them to our God! Well, we did it all the time in the 50s. What I mean is that, like, I'm not going to waste my time like Jimmy Kimmel, you know, ended up doing. And I'm not trying to dog on him, but I'm not going to waste my time talking to somebody who would not mind seeing me dead. in that sense. People who have sort of the mental room to kind of learn different things are basically people who are younger, essentially, to be mean about it. But like, we kind of educate people from the jump that there really is a real fire blanket of, that's a weird word I created, a real blanket discrimination that they have to contend with, because there's been this myth propagated that like discrimination is a thing in the past, but it's everlasting if we let it, or if we become too comfortable with it. It's stuff like, I'm thinking about stuff like Sesame Street, which, you know, yeah, they're puppets, but like also they have these like, you know, very multicultural human kids and multicultural adults and stuff, and things, you know, it's public broadcasting, so it's supposed to be educational. Stuff like that, you know, stuff like Steven Universe, stuff like things that like are smart enough to educate young viewers and educate people who need to see it, how the world ought to be. What aspirations do we kind of want to really achieve into adulthood for the next generation? And I think that like the people who really are used to the idea that everything is fine will defend that status quo, and so they are kind of the enemy. I mean, I don't want them to be. I don't want this to be sort of a black and white us versus them scenario. But realistically,
we didn't make it that way.
Yeah, realistically speaking, we have to, like, you know, we have to treat reality as it is. Otherwise, we can't help anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of thing where for education, where it is most likely to be received, not from people who already know it, but from people who are not already biased by those whose intentions are negative.
Mm-hmm.
Is the best case scenario for having this never happen again, and that's kind of how I've been seeing about things lately. You know, it's like if I feel a certain kind of way about something, if the thing is positive, I'll tell myself to get over it and you know, kind of switch my way of thinking, or just kind of learn, okay, opinion is opinion. If it's negative, then I recognize that I honestly don't like that. And so if people are talking about diversity and inclusion and celebrating different cultures and making a foreigner a friend, there's nothing wrong with that. If people are saying they need to leave because they don't know my language and I heard that they commit crimes, I mean, which is like, you know, again, your basic level, you know, mustache twirling cartoonish lie, then it's just that kind of simple thing where it's like education at the soonest entry point is the way to kind of combat this, because it's going to kind of mold the reality that we actually do live in. Because historically, what has that reality been? People with power have kind of always trodden upon people without power, and those without power are the ones who aren't given space to cultivate their own cultures in this country. You know, whether it's Native Americans, whether it's Black people, whether it's, you know, the Irish in the 20s, whether it's the Italians in the 20s, 30s, Japanese Americans, Latinx people, Hispanic people, Jews, women, like all these instances of them not having a space and them fighting for their spaces and them being fought back by people who had that kind of power. I mean, this is not, it's not some sort of like liberal fever dream. It is our history, and we're at a point now where history is being blurred by people who just happen to trip in front of a treasure chest full of power and are saying, okay, well, I guess I got to do this now so I can make sure I can still have it. In this instance, it's immoral not to do that, I think. It's immoral not to tell people what really is going on. It's immoral not to relate to people the experiences that people are dealing with if they can affect positive change. And I think that, like, to not be engaged at this point is risky for the future, because sooner or later, you know, those in power are going to come for you, and you're not going to understand how that happened until it's too late. And the sooner that you're, this sounds awfully conspiratorial in terms of, like, I've heard the same things being about from like skinheads and stuff, but they're basically using the rhetoric that others who have been oppressed haven't done in the first place. It's just like I said before, it's very cyclical, and it's one of those things where you recognize the past so you can deal with the present and make the better future. Ha ha, that worked out.
And it's so far, I mean, in terms of the cycle, like, you know, racism against Mexicans and Mexican-Americans now is just the flavor of the month. I mean, that's probably always been going on because America and Mexico are so close to each other that they've just always been interacting, and one's skin color is darker than the other, so that automatically means a certain thing. Mm-hmm. But it's just so fucking arbitrary sometimes, like racism, you know? It's just like, oh, well, it's going to be Mexicans now. Why? I don't fucking know.
Yeah, 10 years ago it was most Muslims, and it's like, well, Mexicans are kind of brown.
Yeah, exactly. Well, unfortunately, there's also a cumulative effect, too, because, I mean, we're still a couple of weeks ago I started reading The New Jim Crow, and then that was pretty eye-opening, and just the first page is like how slavery is upheld via mass incarceration, and it's just like, oh yeah, like that never went away. There's always been a way for white people to control black people. In this case, in the modern day, in our post Barack Obama post racism world, it's with prisons. And it's just like, it's like the fucking, the evolution of racism too. It's just like, you got to keep track of that because it's pretty elusive. Like it changes shape. It's like tombs in the X-Files. Oh my God. I can't believe I just said that.
You're exactly. And I'm glad you started reading that. Cause I remember that came about in another college class, and that turned out that my dad had that. So like, yeah, it's a very great book. Yeah. But you're exactly right. Like this whole, you know, it's we have to combat racism, and we have to combat the idea that we're past racism, which I guess is like part of the racism in itself. It's kind of part of the lie. It's okay, well, we had a civil rights movement, that's fine. Okay, well, we had a black president, well, that's fine. It's like these checkpoints, kind of, you know. It's like the guy in, let's say for instance me, you know, doing the job. It's like, okay, am I done now? Okay, there's more to do. Okay, kind of thing. But it's a lot more of a, you know, it's a lot more stark than that.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just like, so racism does have a basis in our psychology, and naturally, like, we're gonna just, our minds trend toward in groups and out groups, whatever. Like that makes sense in terms of survival. Like taking an evolutionary read of that, it makes sense. If you're in the wilderness and you need to understand that, like, you know, your mom is a safer thing than a stranger from Shell Island who's gonna try to take all your shells or whatever in 1 million years BC, Raquel Welch. I don't know. yeah, that's just a lot of words. But I don't think that I think it's when it kind of manifests, especially towards Mexican Americans now and towards everybody else, that's not natural. That is something else. And being artificial and being man-made and American born, I think it can be defeated. I think it can be overcome. And so one of the kind of the constant undone projects in my brain is mapping out different socializations that lead to that kind of extremism, or you know, the extremism that we all have, the racism that is inborn in, or not inborn, but like that develops out of wherever we came from, and can that be kind of interfaced with education and culture and media, like really identifying when somebody turns racist, essentially, what are the events specifically that happen, and then how can you counteract that or even prevent them? And unfortunately, with prevention, like that's where the complication of the podcast comes in, or the episode, where, you know, people, you can't just say people are no different, because differences are important culturally. There are things about, you know, Mexican people that are always going to make them different than people with European heritage, but that's why we have a country called America, because it doesn't matter where you came from, or it doesn't, like, that doesn't make you see, even the terminology is,
well,
hard,
it's also not even that hard to understand. I mean, right. It's if you can consider, like, well, in my family we have this tradition of doing this, well, in my family we have this tradition of doing this, that's essentially what different cultures are.
Right.
It's not like, you know, beyond your kin to figure that, like, well, because somebody, you know, because of this history behind this region of the planet, you know, we can kind of, I mean, we all know this, but like interfacing with this, it's like some people just have such a hard damn time with it, and that's where this false value comes up, where it's like, that's not my country kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about our episode about American Pride and thinking, well, maybe I feel that, like, I kind of let that conversation down in not really trying to seek out where that comes from in the way that, you know, obviously this exists, this concept of pride exists for a very strong reason, obviously. And I feel that, like, I could have gone into it with stronger guns. But I always kind of come back to the idea that whatever those reasons may be are strong enough to justify such hate and such racism. And it's like then it's not worth it. And so if this is the shape it takes, if this is the mask it pulls on, then it doesn't feel like it's something that would survive in the future, and that's how foreigner as a concept would kind of fade away. It would be like, I don't know, like not that foreigner that has to be necessarily a dirty word exactly, but like the idea of it, it's like, well, okay, well, that person's from this place, the idea of certain mandated shows like Captain Planet or whatever, where like literally every kid in that show was from a part of the world, it's one of those things where, okay, well that's obvious, but at the same time, once it's introduced, it's not really thinking about it too much. It's one of those things where in my mind. No one cares about it if they interface with it. I mean, people who don't like transgender people because, you know, they've never dealt with it. There was a thread on Facebook about people just for days bitching and moaning about, like, a panel from a comic book that had a transgender person in it. Like, oh my God, what an agenda. I can't stand this. And it's like every single person who said that just does not interact with trans people in their lives. That's the only reason why they're saying that.
Unless they're harassing them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the same thing if they live in an all-white country. Same thing if they live with all guys. The same thing if they live with no gay people there. The people who are the loudest about this are saying this based on, you know, bedtime stories that they get nightmares from the internet more than anything else. They're not saying this if their boss is Hispanic or if they work, you know, with a lot of Hispanic people. They're not going to say that. And if they do, then they've probably been fired from that job.
Right. And it's just like when I'm kind of visualizing what the future or like, you know, when we talk about utopia or whatever in that way we do, like the way I visualize it is very connected to the promise of America, which is, you know, up for individual interpretation, I suppose. But it's basically where you go to somebody's house and they have some diniguan cooking and you're like, that's weird. That's America. Like, that's America now. That experience is America. Like, maybe you go to a house and they got Kwanzaa decorations. That's America. And then if you have somebody trying to say, well, no, it's not. Then you ask, well, what is then? It's just this stuff you got from Europe. Why is that any different than the stuff people get from Africa or Asia? Or the stuff that fucking existed before Europeans got here? Because I saw something on Twitter that was like somebody – telling a Native American to go back to their country. It's just like, that is a really hard mind to interface with. I admit that's going to be hard. But I think that's kind of the goal that we would have to work backwards from.
What do you think about my pissed off babblings about, you know, fuck the guy who says go back to your country and he's like 65 years old. Do you think that person should be saved or do you think that like we deal with him once we've achieved our goals? And, you know, as I tap my fingers with my gloves on.
Yeah, well, you're just into that like Soylent Green room where it's like assisted suicide where all the old people go or whatever. No, I mean, you do see every once in a while like the story of the old person who's like come around on whatever, even if it's just like, oh, my gay son. And I also saw something on Twitter that was like, let's care about gay people when it's not, oh, my gay son or whatever, and that kind of thing too. But you know, I don't think because perhaps somebody could just say that you were just being ageist because I don't think you ever stop being able to learn things. I mean, old people get really set in their ways, of course.
I'm pretty ageist. I'm not going to lie to you.
I mean, you also hate babies, but that's for something else. That's not really ageism, probably. But I mean, older people have certain life experiences. I mean, they grew up during the 60s, perhaps, and they experienced things that we didn't in terms of, you know, race, like – there's another book that I'm reading that is just fucking fascinating called The Rise of the Warrior Cop, which kind of details like American history through the lens of why the police are so militarized now, beginning really in earnest with Nixon. But they were talking about like the Watts riots and like we didn't see that. We didn't kind of get the impact that left on white America was fucking – I mean you can measure that basically in the SWAT team. Like the reason the SWAT team fucking exists is because of that – and also like weirdly Charles Manson and all this stuff that, or not Manson, not Whitman, and all this like super crime that happened during the 60s, that just kind of got lumped under the banner of Black America, even though I'm pretty sure he wasn't, or maybe he was, I don't know. I don't really honestly know American history that well. But all of the kind of new kinds of crimes that were going on because of the American city in the 60s was basically just blamed on Black people. And so there was this fear of the city that led to the drug war, basically, which was kind of the catalyst for what we have now when you have tanks rolling down suburban streets where instead of white people, there are Black people. And you wonder why is that? And there's a lot of history there, but there's also a lot of fucking stupidity and anxiety that is just artificial. And there's, I think, one of the hugest things in combating racism is investigating the political capital behind racism, because there's no, like, it was incredible. Like, there's the amount of kind of artificially created controversies, especially by Nixon. Like, he would be like, he would be like, you know, kind of proliferate a fear of drugs because there's a re-election, basically.
Yeah.
And that was inherently tied to race. Mm-hmm. And like, that's just like, but I also, there's,
it's diabolical.
It's diabolical and it's unbelievable. But there's also like, perhaps a lot of our racism was artificially created. And if that's the case, then I think it can be subverted.
Yeah, because you have this whole concept of like Black people are lazy, and it's in a way where, like, you know, you have like the whole slave trade of hundreds of years, and, you know, denial of jobs, and, you know, going off to war and coming back and still getting shit upon. Like, this whole thing of like, that's like one of the most arbitrary stereotypes out there. It's like, what the fuck do we? It's like the whole stereotype of, oh, Black people like watermelon. They sure do like watermelon. It's like, that's because they were forced to be watermelon farmers. They could really, that was a crop that they could actually make good upon, and that was turned against them because, oh, well, we don't like them for doing that. Now, it's like everything they fucking do is turned on their head. It's like, oh, they're these, you know, oh, well, they can play basketball. Oh, that means they're these strong, monstrous, you know, kind of scary people who we don't want dating our white daughters. It's like,
exactly.
Every fucking single thing they do.
Yeah, that is really frustrating. Right, yeah. Who am I?
It's that kind of thing. Yeah, it's Nixon. So predictably, we got kind of angry at the end of this. Some really interesting text that I mean to put up on that site, and I hope that you'll share those last couple ones that you were mentioning. So is there anything else that you kind of like want to hit up in terms of this conversation? I mean, I know we kind of started out broad, kind of really drilled down to like this specific needle point. Is there anything that you kind of was kind of going on in your head that you might want to talk about, or are we kind of at the end here?
I mean, we're definitely at the end. I just want to make sure that we even kind of address the question, which was, is foreigner an outdated term? Like, what would be your conclusion on that? Yes or no, basically, and then explain, given you several lines underneath.
Yes, teacher. Yeah, I was like telling my mom, like, you know, we're talking about this episode, is foreigner an outdated concept? And she instantly said, yes, because this, and reasons which I didn't necessarily jot down in my brain, but like, she asked, what do you think? And I
was
like,
whatever, mom.
Give me my jelly beans. She asked me what I thought. I was like, you know, I don't know, because I felt that it's certainly something I would want to happen, but like, I couldn't allow myself to say, because saying that now felt like, you know, saying that there's no such thing as racism, at least in my brain, because it was like, well, because look how people are being treated. But when we started talking about tonight, it's like, well, I suppose to some people it is in the best possible way, and they're not, you know, they're not being willfully ignorant about it. They're kind of like saying, how do you perceive somebody? And in some ways, it's being kind of kept alive through policy and through propaganda and through gaslighting and all that kind of stuff. It is not outdated, but it is past its expiration date. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I can grok that.
All right.
I mean, I just think that when foreigner, I think it will be outdated, hopefully soon, and it will fade away, but not with culture, that culture and different kinds of culture never goes away. But when, like right now, I think kind of the fallacy we fall into is believing that ours is any more un-American or foreign. Because basically, like, when people come over the border, any border, and have their different set of rules and histories interface with ours, we are facing them with a Eurocentric culture that is no more American than what theirs can be. And so I think when people kind of come together in our utopia, it's complicated, but it's ultimately that there's a baseline of friendship and arguably, you know, what can you do for me, or can I see you as family? There's still going to be cultures that were from that were born not from America, but I think that's just going to kind of become America, basically. And so all my wrestling with the idea of heritage is just like, you know, it's going to change. I think heritage, you know, foreign heritage or whatever, and American heritage are going to have to kind of meet in the middle. And obviously, that's not what we're seeing with DACA and our current administration. But that's what I am hoping we will see, and that's what we have to kind of work towards, I guess.
Just very quick before we end up here, I was thinking about like episode from Craziest Girlfriend where she was like, hanging out with was it Josh's sisters or Valencia's? It was before the wedding, like in season one, I think.
Oh yeah, that would have been Josh's sisters.
Right. And like, I don't remember it getting too different of culture, but I do remember that kind of like popping in and out very quickly. And I was thinking, like, have you ever had that, you know, gone to somebody's house and, you know, it being kind of a very different kind of culture thing?
No, I wasn't invited over people's houses.
After what you did.
Yeah. Well, I'm like, not for any reason, but that's just never how it, like, I was always the one in, like, the friend group who would invite other people over, which is just, that's just kind of how it happened. But, yeah, I wish I could say, like, if I ever ran into a situation where there was such a different culture that I had to kind of like deal with. When, you know, after college and moving out to Los Angeles, I was tutoring a series of older Asian people, both Japanese. And so I spent a lot of time, like once a week, I would meet with this older Japanese woman and she would kind of regale me with stories of her youth. And she just had like this crazy life story that I can't even believe I believed, but she was like, you know, I would date this like billionaire who's like kind of ugly or whatever. Like she was very like brusque about a lot of details, and it was pretty funny. But I don't even know why I brought that up.
I want to hear this.
Well, what was the question actually? Because I feel like
if you had never interface with people's different cultures.
Yeah, and so you know, she talked about how she was good at English when she was like working in a bar, but obviously back then it was kind of hard to get work as a Japanese woman in like the 60s, I imagine this was. But yeah, I mean, she seemed so inherently foreign in a lot of respects, in a lot of respects that I would have to RESPECT. But at the same time, she was somebody who I could just talk to. And she had to learn English to do that. And I was teaching her English. So there was also kind of a construction of the communication, which wasn't really happening because I was a terrible teacher, which is fine. I mean, I fell into that kind of bass backwards. But yeah, I mean, but yeah, I don't know how, in your case, in your past, were there any situations like that?
Well, I mentioned my friend Mina from like grade school. Mm-hmm. And also like when I was dating Jan and I visited her parents' house, which is actually the first time I actually visited girlfriend's parents, but her mother is Korean and like lived her half her life in Korea. She's like in her 60s, I believe, and her father is black, and so their house, very nice house, you know, every now and then there were sort of these like Korean pamphlets. I believe they went to a Korean church. I might be getting that wrong, but you know, they took me to like a Korean restaurant. And her mom made like several dishes that were kind of like very. I mean, she made like steak and stuff like that, but it was also kind of like different. And it was kind of just a very. It wasn't one solid thing. It was kind of a very blended kind of culture. It really wasn't like, you know, like a non-American different culture, but it was. It wasn't straight up, you know, visiting somebody who was like one or the other kind of thing. And yeah, that was one of those, it didn't necessarily stick in my mind the entire time, but I was remembering, oh yeah, this is something that I've not gotten in a while in terms of, you know, whether it's dating somebody or kind of going to somebody's house or whatever. And that's always cool because it's like, not that that would perceive that as like visiting some sort of like, you know, ethnic restaurant exactly.
Stepping through the door. Oh.
Yeah. But it's just one of those things where it's like, this is this perspective of living or whatever. Mm. And it's cool. I really enjoy that. And I think that like, I can't grok the perspective of those who wouldn't, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The people who get to decide who's American and who's not. I mean, that's always the core frustration.
Yeah, that's what makes my fist squeeze.
Yeah. Email time?
Email time. I read the last one last week. Would you want to do this one or do you want me to do it?
Sure. I just have to remember how to read. Okay. Tank, I need a schematic on how to read.
I'll tell you that in a second when we're done.
Okay. A Matrix-related story. Yes. So this one comes in from Michael Ridge on February 6th. Hi, Harry and Don. It's clear that Queer Eye from the Straight Guy used a common stereotype about gay men to attract an audience. The show wasn't about the five guys. It was about the straight guy and his girlfriend / fiance / wife. It was comparable to the women who work at car shows to demonstrate the car but are really there to bring in the men that the company thinks will buy their product. Mm. This seems to be the best example of conification. As a side note, kind of like the spokeswoman for the NRA.
Or the bikini with the rifle or whatever.
Yeah. And then he continues, it is less clear when a show adds gay or lesbian characters as secondary characters but never really deals with their complete life. MASH, for example, had a black nurse and an Asian nurse, a Jewish doctor, an Asian doctor, etc. The Jewish doctor was the only one who had an episode focused on him. The others were around, but never took focus for more than a brief scene. The movie was about two doctors who did their best to cope with the terrible things they saw. The series had to broaden the story to keep going week after week for years. They didn't choose to bring out any non-majority characters. I think this is tokenism rather than commodification. A lot of shows now have a gay character, but they're just checking a box rather than trying to bring a reality into the program. Secondary characters are the reverse of the toys in Toy Story. They only come alive when they are needed to interact with main characters. It's harder to find either commodification or tokenism in a show like Will and Grace, which you mentioned in your discussion. In this show, a gay character is one of the principals, and another gay character is a substantial supporting character. The two gay characters represent two different kinds of men. We see the mainly gay characters in most areas of his life, at work, at home, looking for romance, and very occasionally dating. We do not see any bedroom scenes or even any displays of affection, kissing, hugging, etc., though a sexual life is sometimes included by references. This is a network show, and there are significant limits on what they could show, but they don't seem to be trying to go as far as they would be allowed. It certainly isn't a show that fully realizes any of the characters. But Grace, the straight lead, doesn't fare any better. She even gets married and divorced without having any realistic relationship with her husband. I think the show should get a pass because the characters are treated the same way, whether gay, straight, or bisexual. Karen's character seems to me to be willing to find acceptance with either a man or a woman based on her mother's use of her daughter as a shill in confidence games. I haven't watched either Oz or Orange is the New Black, so I can't comment on these programs that seem to get a positive reaction by you and your guests. I did understand that these are both shows about life in prison. Are there any shows that you consider positive that are set in more familiar settings, like a workplace, drama, or comedy, a mystery story, a meeting play story like Cheers? Anyway, a very interesting episode. And then I suppose I got to click to say the Michael Ridge.
Yeah, no, I didn't say anything. Thank you very much, Michael. From his earlier point, yeah, like I was thinking when he was mentioning MASH, I was thinking about the Futurama episode of MASH.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of an instance because, like, Amy is, like, Chinese-American, I think, and, like, you know, she's a supporting character, but, like, there are, in all the years that show was on, she's had episodes about her and, you know, character development for her, and you see her parents who are, like, rich farmers or something.
Yeah, really, like, greedy.
Yeah, no, and it's, like, where it's, like, Billy West and, Lauren Tom,
yes.
Doing wacky voices.
Yeah.
I mean, I can think of shows, is he asking for like queer characters examples or like just any minority character? I think queer characters, where they're kind of, you know, kind of like main. I mean, one show that comes to mind immediately is Supergirl, and I kind of had to find this out, but like in the second season, there was this major storyline where Supergirl's adoptive sister, Alex, realizing her sexuality and being attracted to like the first, basically the first gay woman that she knew, and then that gay woman was like, I don't know about this, but I watched that, and honestly, I thought it was actually really good because it was a main character. It was you don't see a main character kind of discover their sexuality. I've never really watched Ellen, so I'm not sure exactly how that went down, but like it is rare that like a major character kind of is revealed to be more of a minority than previously presumed. But that's definitely one thing that like, and of course, you know, the whole like, you know, thing with Steven Universe and Pearl, which if you listen to like 2017's Shipper Spotlight on Batgirl Oracle, you'll hear me West-poet about that. But what would you say about workplace dramedy, comedy, mystery story, in terms of like, you know, positive examples of queer characters?
One show that I've been keeping my eye on for a number of reasons is Madam Secretary, which is kind of a snore to watch. And it's got this really weird performance by Taya Leone, who, like, she's just, the way she says words, it's just like, it's not how I remembered from Jurassic Park 3, but maybe that wasn't the best example either. But that's a show that's about, I think, the State Department, and it's all about, like, diplomacy. So they're like, oh, let's get, like, Russia on the phone because we need to get immigrants or refugees out of this one country, and maybe can they open their borders? Well, what do they do for us, or what do we do for them? And it's kind of interesting that way. I never saw The West Wing, so this is kind of my political show. Not that I watch it, but I watch it for work. And I think they do kind of try to be a bit Sorkin-esque, but they don't quite get there. But there was one episode where they have a pretty new character who's like, you know, definitely not a traditional woman, and she, I guess she was in her past, but she kind of realized her sexuality, and I forget the way she described herself, but she was like, it was a very, very cutting edge, like modern, like description, where she was like, I would describe myself as bisexual plus this other thing, plus like non-binary, like all these words that like people don't really understand, that I don't understand, for example, and it was a scene where she was explaining it to a guy who was like, you know, trying to figure it out. He literally says, I'm wandering into foot and mouth territory here, but like, what, you know, kind of like complete my sentence. There was also a really great scene. Well, it wasn't a great scene, but it was a pretty funny scene in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend where Kevin was trying to get, Heather's ethnicity, like say, oh, yeah, what you are. That was pretty funny. And also Valencia came out as bisexual recently and yes, super low key on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, so that's, I guess.
Well, they cheated because of the time skip, but like the moment that character walked around the screen, I'm like, I see where this is going.
Yeah,
I was actually going to mention that because like White Josh, I feel that like his evolution has been pretty organic because he came out, he was a supporting character. There was a perception of him that he was going to be kind of this sort of like a shallow guy, but he was kind of just normal who just happened to like work out or whatever, and then it was revealed that he was gay, which was seen as no big deal, which because of that made you realize something about Daryl's sexuality. That was kind of used as a springboard, kind of have Daryl explore his own sexuality. So then White Josh, the gay character, and Daryl, the bisexual character, are kind of, you know, seen together, and then in season 3 I feel that White Josh has had more focus because of that. So it's been kind of like this gradual thing where a queer character wasn't exactly, well, a queer character was focused from the first season, but it was sort of like an evolution of a character focus, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. You can definitely feel their anxiety about like, well, we want to say it's important, but not make it a big deal and like not fall into like all the traps that other people have just gleefully strode into or striven. I don't know. But yeah, I think Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is pretty good. I mean, you look at any example from the GLAAD nominees.
Yes.
The Good Place, The Bold Type, Steven Universe, these kinds of shows that are often held in high regard.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel that like I feel that lately gay characters feel a lot less I hate this word, but forced than they used to.
Yes.
Like totally. I remember on The Flash where his police chief had just offhandedly referenced that his boyfriend was like, oh, he kind of comments on the stuff that I eat or whatever. And it was kind of like in and out there. It's like, oh, okay. And then like, I think he got injured and his boyfriend showed up, at the guy's like hospital bed or whatever. And it was just very much like matter of fact. Like, of course these aren't like major characters, but it was the first time I remember seeing a mainstream superhero show kind of, introduce that actually had real world reality. And then Supergirl happened. I know that like they made Mr. Terrific gay in Arrow. I know White Canary is bisexual in Legend of Tomorrow. In Black Lightning, his daughter Anissa. Oh man, like there was a pretty racy, like post-coitus scene between his daughter Anissa, who's gay, and her girlfriend in like the second episode, which actually kind of surprised me. But it was actually really, really sweet and very like unapologetic about it, which I thought was really cool. And I know they've introduced Grace Choi, who they get together in the comics, so that's going to be happening soon. So it'll be like an interracial relationship between like a black woman and a Asian woman. I'm not sure what the other thing that is, but like the CW superhero shows have been pretty queer friendly, I think, and kind of growing in scope as well as quality about that.
I mean, I feel like even their vampire and supernatural stuff has been pretty decent. I mean, not literally supernatural, because I don't know, other than the queer baiting between the brothers, which is another issue. But you know, the Vampire Diaries and the originals, like they've been pretty good in terms of racial diversity as well. Especially the originals, which takes place in New Orleans, or Norlins, as people might say. But yeah, I feel like every once in a while you have a gay guy. You also have the assassination of Gianni Versace going on right now, which is a little different. But I watched a video where it was basically like, what would they say? That basically it's the title American Crime Story, which is completely cumbersome and I hate it. Basically refers to the crime that is very American and kind of indicts the whole country, basically. Like in the first season is about there's a lot of stuff about, you know, race relations and also like celebrity and sexism with Marsha Clark and all this kind of stuff. And I guess in the new season it's about misunderstanding the gay community and misunderstanding Gianni Versace, misunderstanding Andrew Cannon. I'm only two episodes in. It's not as good as the first one, obviously. I don't think anybody was expecting that, but it's okay. And definitely interesting. Just jumps around like crazy. But yeah, so that's interesting too. I mean, that's a case where you kind of, it's a more traditional approach to queer characters, which is like that kind of like the tragic that we were talking about with Peter, that you don't really get from GLAAD nominees, which is more about these people are, you know, people as they might be, and either be neutral or celebrate them, but not kill them and talk about how they're just so crime ridden and all that, like cruising and all that stuff. Like, we're kind of past that, I like to think.
I would like, I mean, Peter's not here, so here's the test if he actually listens to the show, but like he brought up Static, like the comic book Static, and like how, oh, they made Rick gay and that was just so he could be sad. And I kind of want to challenge him on that, because I actually thought that was a really like believable storyline, because like his classmate comes out as gay after a few issues of kind of implying it, but like not really kind of focusing on it. And Static has a pretty negative reaction to it, as a teenager in the 90s would, but that homophobia is directly kind of confronted. And I felt that, like, not to say that, like, you know, the perspective of the homophobe should exactly be paramount, exactly, but, like, I felt that, like, in the, I'm not seeing a story kind of, like, treat homosexuality, or at least, you know, kind of friendships in that way, where it kind of go in and out from homophobia to not only acceptance, but kind of understanding that perspective. And I kind of want to get more into that, but of course he's not here, so I can't. But I did think that was interesting, especially for the time, which was like 1995, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And a comic book aimed at teenagers and stuff.
Right, yeah.
But
comic books.
Comic books.
They're always, yeah. So.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael, and feel free to email in again. If you guys have any other thoughts on, we got a lot of feedback from the Peter's last episode. If you have any other thoughts on that episode or this episode or any episode that you've listened to, email in at qnoanswers@gmail.com, and also join our Facebook page where we drop the episodes and comment on that page and give us your thoughts on any potential topics at on the Questions and We Have No Answers Facebook page.
Tweet us on YouTube, all that good stuff.
Instagram, Snapchat.
Yep. Oh, man. Check out my story.
I want to say at the end, the last, is that that is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room and we are all, at least we like to think we are, relatively civilized. And we can talk to each other at least on certain levels. So that we could walk out of here assuming that the measure of our enlightenment, or at least our politeness, has some effect on the world. It may not. I remember, for example, when the ex-Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn with which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president. What is dangerous here is the turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation and in spite of the Johnson landslide is the one that's been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know, and neither does Martin Luther King, none of us know, how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years. It seems to me that the city of New York, for example, this is my last point, which had Negroes in it for a very long time. If the city of New York were able, as it has indeed been able, in the last 15 years to reconstruct itself, tear down buildings and raise great new ones, downtown and for money, and has done nothing whatever except build housing projects in the ghetto for the Negroes. And of course the Negroes hate it. Presently the property does indeed deteriorate because the children cannot bear it. They want to get out of the ghetto. If the American pretensions were based on more solid, a more honest assessment of life and of themselves, it would not mean for Negroes, when someone says urban renewal, that Negroes simply are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it does mean now. This is not an act of God. We're dealing with a society made and ruled by men. If the American Negro had not been president in America, I am convinced that the history of the American labor movement would be much more edifying than it is. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I'm not an object of missionary charity. I'm one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
Next time on Questions We Don't Have Answers, Dating It and You / Another Perspective in Dating, or Sexuality in Creativity, essentially creating things to visualize the sex you want to have. Doesn't that sound fun, kids? Next week is Valentine's Day. That is right? Yeah, it is. So, it will be another love theme. This has been a very lovey year for this podcast, I think.
But, yes.
But those will be the potential topics. We're not exactly settled on which one we will kind of come down on, but it will definitely involve one or both. So get ready for that, and let's curl up with your sweetheart and listen to that episode. I think go to bed feeling all frigid. anything else for this episode, Harrison?
Fuck the term illegal immigration and fuck ICE.
Yeah. I agree with what you said. I'm not necessarily familiar with ICE, but yeah, fuck that.
Yeah.
All right. Adios. Sayonara. Advitazen.
Advitazen.
Advitazen, yes. Tu vida.